A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we are giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music.
Hey, welcome to the 252nd episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Dave Fairman, Emilio Torres, and Maddie Delk. I'm Matt Enlow.
And I'm Warren Kaplan, and today we have on Fisher Stevens, who has just directed a new film called Palmer, starring Justin Timberlake, Juno Temple, June Squibb. It's coming out on Apple Plus tomorrow, if you're listening to this. So Fisher Stevens, is he our first Oscar winner on the podcast? No. Dean Pariseau is for a short film, but Fisher won for a feature film, produced The Cove documentary.
Yeah, Fisher, you might know him from a couple of different disciplines. He's an actor, he's a producer, and he's a director. And so you've seen him in stuff like since the 80s. He was in Friends for a minute there.
He's a regular on The Blacklist, Succession, Vice Principals.
Yeah, pretty exciting. He's an accomplished actor, but also, like you said, an Oscar-winning producer, and then also a feature film director. So he's got his hands full, so he kind of bounces between the three of them. And we talk a little bit about what he looks for in his next project or when he's putting something together. What keeps him passionate about things. And also, you know, I think he's the first to say that this is a film, Palmer is a film that he really loves and adores, but he specifically kind of wanted to maintain a level of artistic control that meant that the budget was smaller and what the trade-offs between control versus time ended up being. And so it's a really fascinating, in-depth conversation. He's a super smart guy. We really dig in. He's really generous with his time, and we've got a lot of ground that we cover. So Palmer's out January 29th. It's probably already out on Apple TV by the time you're listening. So check it out if you want to get even more context for what we're talking about with Fisher Stevens.
But before we talk to Fisher, I'm dying to know, Matt, what have you been working on lately? And do we have any iTunes reviews?
You know, I that's funny. The answer is the same for both. I've mostly been working on reading all of the iTunes reviews again. Because when I get a little low, it's nice to hear your encouragement, everybody, and also your criticism. So we've got one from Cal Barnes.
You know,
Barnes.
Matt, that I go in there and I remove all the negative reviews, right?
I thought you go in and drag me. You create fake names and we're like, Oren's great, oh, yeah. But Matt leaves a little to be desired.
Actually, all the reviews are by me. I'm Glenn Montgomery, Greco Bo, and Cal Barnes.
Well, you managed to change up your voice very convincingly. So here we go. We'll show your latest work from Cal Barnes. Great show that covers the process of filmmaking. This is a solid show in the Filmmaking Podcast Network. I've been listening to Oren and Matt's podcast along with a select handful of others as I've been directing my own first feature the last few years. Very informative. They cover a good array of topics and some great discoveries have been made. In these wild times we're living in with an onslaught of overinformation, it's great to have a few solid staples that deliver great content and episodes on a regular basis. Remember, when all else fails, just shoot it. It's a great call to action. Hey, thanks, Cal.
It is. Yeah, thanks, Cal. I love being a staple. A staple in the wound of your ego. Yeah.
No, we're just sealing a wound shut so that it can heal, right?
Yeah,
we're like the liquid stitches of
you just got shot
filmmaking.
Yeah, we're the staple.
Well, before we go through this metaphor any longer, we just want to say thanks Thanks, Cal. We appreciate it. If you write an iTunes review, we will read it out loud. So feel free to plug, say, a feature that you're working on or anything else. Cal, thank you so much. But Oren, I'm actually curious. The reason that you sound different today is because you're recording with AirPods because you're on a job. So I'm really curious to know what you have been working on lately.
Well, so I'm on a job. I'm in Columbus, Ohio. I flew here on an airplane wearing an N95 mask and a surgical mask. And my wife made me wear a face shield, which, I'm not going to lie, I was like a little...
And goggles.
Well, the goggles like are kind of connected to the face shield.
Oh, I see. That's nice. Okay.
It's like these glasses that hold the plastic.
Did they have lenses in front of them?
I don't think.
Oh, okay. So it's just like frames. Yeah. I've seen that, actually. Those are more comfortable than the elastic band ones. I should get one of those, actually.
Yeah. But I had like a real N95. I hope this doesn't get me in trouble. I don't know if there's like a massive shortage or anything. It was like not the KN95, it was the real N95. I got it from a doctor friend. My wife is pregnant and I have a kid and we're part of this. My kid is in the school where like everyone is just like very insulated and no one is supposed to bring any COVID into the group. So my number one goal for this entire trip is to not get COVID. So I did that. And then she made my DP also wear a face mask, not because she was concerned about his safety, but more so that I wouldn't feel like the weirdo with the face mask. And he was cool. He wore it too. But I was pleasantly surprised to see that there were like a bunch of other people, not so much on the airplane, but at the airport wearing face masks and stuff. And I felt less weird. I don't know.
Did you see anyone in coveralls? Like, I've seen photos of people like basically wearing a painter's suit.
Oh, like fully insulated from COVID. Oh, and then they take it off when they're done.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I did, but people are pretty good. A few noses peeking out here and there. And of course, like as you leave California, like when we got to Ohio, like all the security guys outside the airport weren't wearing any masks, which I thought was pretty shocking. But, and here at the hotel, like the bar is open and there's people sitting there and drinking drinks. I mean, there's no like valets. There's these other things that are closed because of COVID, but it seems like there are plenty of opportunities to catch COVID if you wanted to. Like you can eat inside a restaurant here. Anyway, it's just interesting how things differ, but on set it's pretty safe, take temperature and everyone wears masks and we eat far away from each other and there's no like buffet style food. But
which is maybe an upgrade.
Yeah.
It's more expensive, which is a bummer, but I feel like, you just get your box lunch and you have a little bit of space. So that's not too bad.
Well, so something that's like kind of interesting about this shoot that I thought was worth discussing for like 2 minutes at most. So we're shooting four spots over the course of 3 days and then these like four other kind of digital explainer spots that kind of go with the main spots. It's kind of a lot of, and it's
like industrials, kind of
more like for Instagram. They're like how to, it's for a product.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Yeah.
I can say it's like for a paint product. And so the commercials are more, they're these 15 second spots for the paint, but these other videos are how to videos. They kind of like show you how to do certain projects with the paint, but it's hard because we have to really do the projects, but paint takes time to dry. We have to do all these different things. And anyway, to make a long story short, I'm not like exactly sure how we're going to shoot everything, like what we're going to do. I mean, I have a good idea. We have storyboards and all this stuff, but like, I know that this angle, like, we can draw it in the storyboard, but I don't know that we'll really get it.
You know what shots you want, but also the logistics of the project could override some of the.
Yeah. Like I want to shoot.
Artistic idea.
Yeah, this shot and then this shot, but we can't because this paint wouldn't go here and the tape would go here and whatever. But I guess I was kind of curious about your experience with like kind of going into a shoot, especially a commercial shoot, knowing 70% of what you're going to do. Is it because I'm usually like pretty much at like 95% before I go into a shoot, like knowing what the shots are, what the order of the shots are, and like how the frame is going to look. But now I'm really, and I even told my DP who's, as a director, everyone's like, okay, so are you going to see this? Are you going to see this? Are you going to do this? And I'm like, always so scared to say, I don't know. Well, but today I told our DP, I was like, just think of this as like, here's our plan more or less, but like, if we see a better shot, we're going to take the better shot. If this angle feels weird, we're going to do a different angle. And let's just kind of like approach this. Like I told our cinematographer to think of it as like a Sawhorse shoot, which our friends, we have a production company, Sawhorse. A lot of times they'll be like, hey, tomorrow we got to shoot this person doing this thing. And then you just show up and figure out how to shoot it. And, you don't usually do that with commercials unless they're kind of like lifestyle-y commercials, but even when they are lifestyle-y commercials. So I don't know, I guess have you gone into commercial shoots kind of like 70% knowing what you're going to shoot?
Yeah, the answer is certainly. It's been kind of a while. I think that you and I both have progressed to the point where the expectation is that you walk somebody through literally every single frame. Like, you know, everything's boarded and this and that. My College Humor days when we were doing stuff with like Jake and Amir in particular, where they're like
more sketch comedy
chemistry. It was sketch comedy, but also like a lot of improv, you know, like a lot of improv. And you would light things globally and you just kind of catch things and you had soft beat sheets. But yeah, so you weren't sure how things were going to go, but also they didn't need to be cut to a specific time. And then also, actually, you're reminding me that I did some like Dunkin' Donuts videos like a couple like years ago now. We had to do like some like tabletop-y, like top down sort of like magical quote unquote Facebook style videos, basically of like, this is how you make Dunkin' Donuts into like a cake or something like that. And, you know, and you'd see like, you know, a set of hands would like put a bowl down and then like butter would appear and then, you know, they'd stir the butter and, you know, like that sort of very like top down Facebook style stuff. But we only had so many of these special edition Dunkin' Donuts. And so you kind of had to make it in real time. Like, and we had a chef there and
the
all
PAs
this stuff
in the corner. You're like, how many donuts did you eat?
What? No. They were like peppermint type or something. And we were doing it early enough in the run that they hadn't really manufactured enough of the materials that the chef needed to assemble things. So it was like, it was something where it was like, we had it's been years now, so I'm fuzzy on the details, but it was like regular Dunkin' Donuts, but then you would combine them with a certain type of frosting or whatever that they didn't have a ton of. But so, yeah, so you had to do them in real time, which is similar to painting. So the ideal way to do it for people listening at home, as I'm sure you can guess, is like to have an art team kind of doing stages of the process, basically. So you get things, you kind of figure out what are the benchmarks, and you have a couple that are further along so that you can kind of swap things out and redo things as you go. And so there's one or two that you're actually doing in real time, but that there are a couple others that maybe start out in different stages. And then also there are people standing by to actually catch up. So like once you've done the first couple stages, if there were, you know, you have three, whatever, birdhouses in various stages that you can kind of have people building them along once you no longer need the earlier stages, for instance. But is it with talent? What are the mandates from the team? Also, you know, when you said four spots in 3 days, I was like, ooh la la, Oren. I had no idea. This is great. But then adding four explainer videos on top of that, that could be very art dependent, it gets a little hairier.
Yeah, we also, like, we're painting these things and they're real vintage things that we got like on eBay and stuff, and like these old items, and we only have two of each thing that we had to very carefully source. So we have a finished version and an unfinished version, which means we only get one take to like, if we're painting something, we only get one take to paint it because we only have one of them.
Is it spray paint?
And this is
or
a 15
is it,
second.
It's, or is it
yeah,
like
spray paint? And it is a 15 second spot with a 2 second end card, so we have 13 seconds for the whole thing.
Hold on, I just want to make sure I'm clear here. Let's say it's a birdhouse. You got a vintage birdhouse that's all messed up, it's rusty, and you know you need to fix it or whatever, and then you have one that's 100% done.
Because the reality is, if you wanted to paint it as perfectly as we want it to be painted at the end, that
you
birdhouse
to take your time.
would take like a day, an entire day to paint.
Yeah.
And we need to shoot three of these how-to videos in the right light with the right thing, with all the approvals and everything in that day. So we had to have like the finished one. We also are shooting some things kind of out of order, and we basically needed the finished one and a totally unfinished one both. And today we were like, oh man, we wish we had like five copies of each thing so we can have it at different stages, just like you're saying, just like those donuts. It's going to totally be fine, but it's
you know, yeah, that's exactly right. Like, it's more that it just creates some stress and rigidity in your schedule that you know how to work around if you had another couple birdhouses. That's all. How many cameras are you
shooting? It also changes your approach a little bit. Yeah. And that like, instead of like, this is going to be this precise movement and this precise, and it's going to cut on this, you know, it's a little bit more like, this is the idea. We're going to do a dynamic camera movement. I don't know. I'm not going to know what it is until you see it, and then you can give a note on it, you know.
How many cameras?
One for like the commercial, and then we're throwing a second one, the how-to videos. And I brought my Sony A7S, you know, just in case. Made a...
No GoPro, though? No, like, time-lapse-y or, like, no. Bug's eye view or anything?
Well, the, like...
That wouldn't match the aesthetic.
There would be, like, an overhead shot angle, you know, kind of like your donut thing. Yeah. But we're not sure which camera yet. You know, it's interesting because like in those situations, I'm sure you've been in them. It's like you're actually negotiating more with your cinematographer than you are with like the agency and the client or the producer, because your cinematographer, when you're like, oh, I got my Sony A7S here and we got a Red camera, like, can we throw those in? And he's like, well, those aren't going to match. We have like an Alexa with master primes. Like, and now you're going to cut it with this like DSLR. Like, this isn't going to look good. And you're like, yeah, but this spot is not about looking good. It's about kind of like this fun how-to video, you know? So not that it won't look good, but it's like, it's not like a broadcast TV spot, you know?
Yeah, I think that's kind of why I like GoPro, because they feel so different.
It's like self, yeah, it's almost like self-aware.
Yeah. Like it's not supposed to blend, you know? It's like surveillance camera footage or something. Like we know it's a different thing. And we, as an audience, are familiar with what cell phone footage looks like and GoPro footage looks like. Yes,
we've all heard Jordan Brady's story about how he shot his security footage of that Kool-Aid commercial or whatever it was with a real security camera.
Oh, I haven't heard that story. That's good, though.
Anyhow, we should probably let Fisher Stevens speak a little bit. Before we do, though, I do want to remind people that we have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/justshootitpod. It is a place where if you wanted to give us a couple dollars a month, because you feel like you get something out of the podcast, you feel like it's helping you, you're short just got into Sundance or Slam Dance or Neighbor's Yard Dance, you know, just drop us a couple bucks, you know, you'll get some stickers, $10, you'll get a hat, $20, you'll get a t-shirt. And I think we're going to have some more Patreon remote events. Man, I cannot wait till we are all herd immunized
through vaccines
or just all having had COVID.
I'm ready for that
live
vaccine.
Shows.
Yeah.
They're kind of like one of the highlights of the podcast for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty great. So we'll be there soon. In the meantime, though, the online events have been really fun as well. So we'll have a few more of those in the near future as well.
Yeah. And so patreon.com/justshootitpod. And let's talk to Fisher. Congrats on the movie. Hey folks, we're interrupting this incredible episode of the podcast to tell you about a new sponsor that we're working with, Front Row Insurance Brokers. One of the challenges of being a filmmaker is that there's a lot of risks that we take, and we really just want to focus on making good stuff. So what if there was a company that could take those risks, manage them for us while we are being artists?
That's right. Front Row Insurance Brokers arranges film production insurance to cover the risks associated with your production. They cover features, TV shows, documentaries, commercials, music videos, webisodes, basically anything you can watch on big, medium or phone-sized screens.
Yeah, Front Row will help you focus on your artistic vision by transferring all the risks to them and minimizing your production hazards. And they cover any budget from $2,000 all the way up to $200 million. There's nothing that's too small or too big.
If you are shooting in Canada, use coupon code JUSTSHOOTIT50OFF for $50 off your film production insurance. That's promo code JUSTSHOOTIT50OFF to save $50.
And if you're shooting in the U.S., that same code can be redeemed offline by mentioning it to a broker, by email, or over the phone.
It's like a cool password if you're in the U.S. That's Just Shoot It 50 off.
Check him out. Let us know how it goes. Congrats on Palmer. How's
Thank
it going?
Thank you so much. It's going well. Yeah. I mean, it's exciting. You know, it's like giving birth to your baby that's finally going to see the world. Something I've really, you know, you get nervous before the opening when the reviews come out. And my wife is like, don't even read them, you know, and I'm like, I know. And then, of course, I try not to read them, but it can't help it.
Do you read like the little blurb, like, you know, on Variety and stuff, they'll just have like one sentence at the top that hints at whether they like it or not. Do you read that and that tells you whether you read the rest of it?
Yeah, I guess, sadly. I mean, I this one's going to be weird. I just, you know, the thing that's different about this movie is that there's no box office So you can't judge by box office. And as you know, often a movie will get terrible reviews, but it'll do great at the box office. And then the director will go on to make a million more movies. So this time there's no box office, which is kind of good because it can't really fail at the box office, but it can fail with the reviews, obviously. So I don't know. We were just talking, my wife and I, Lexi, about, you know, you can't read them all. Don't do it. Don't do it to yourself. You know, just preparing myself. So anyway.
I think it's fascinating to hear someone like you say that, you know, that the success of this movie kind of helps determine your next project and how many more movies you get to make, because you have 40 producing credits, including one Oscar win, and you have 22 directing credits. Like, it doesn't seem like a question mark whether you have a directing career or not.
I think you maybe made it, Fisher. You know,
well, you know, the thing is, thank you though. But I know doing these interviews just makes you realize like how old you are and how long you've been doing this. But my last movie, definitely my last feature that I directed, was a bit scarring in terms of the reception. So I'm
stand-up prepared guys?
I'm prepared for anything.
I think it's interesting, though, that you're framing it in the world of streaming, right? Because as filmmakers, you're right. Like, there is that question of, like, what does success look like, right? Especially, like, different platforms have different metrics, have different standards for what success even is, you know? The numbers on a Netflix have to be different than the numbers on an Apple Plus or an HBO Max or whatever. Like, it's all kind of this internal sort of rubric that they must each have, you know?
Yeah.
And so...
Interesting. And I have no idea what that is, by the way. But yes.
Right. Yeah. They could be like, hey, you know, we're a hit. And you'd be like, well, what does that mean?
Yeah.
You know?
I'm curious, though, from a philosophical standpoint, like, if you really compartmentalize your directing career from your acting career, because like I'm right now you're on these like hit shows, right? You're on The Blacklist, you're on Succession, you're on Vice Principals, you're in The Night Of, like just these like kind of
prestige shows.
Yeah, prestige, you know, shows that everyone knows, that are winning awards, that do all this stuff. Do you separate that from your directing career? Because we look at someone like an Olivia Wilde or someone that has like this really amazing acting career and then makes her first movie and now has a directing career. And of course, those two things are connected to each other. Right.
Yeah, we live on the same block, so I'm sure there's been some kind of energy. Ooh, good energy. I'm hoping her energy rubs off on my career. But well, look, directing documentaries versus directing features versus acting, it's all different. Like this film in particular, Palmer, was probably one of the most difficult things that I've ever done. And I want to say that whether or not it's a hit or it's critically acclaimed, honestly, the reality is it doesn't matter. It was an incredible experience. I loved it. It was tough, but it was, when I take a job, it's really, especially as I get older, it's all about the experience. And this was a magical, incredible experience, even ups and downs, trying to get it made, not getting, you know, having it almost go at one point, then shutting down and starting again, new cast, new everything. But regardless, all joking aside, it's been an incredible win because of just the making of it. Now, the second part, as you bring up, making features, I loved the experience of directing a feature. So I hope I have another opportunity to do it. But again, regardless of whatever happens, that Palmer itself was a great experience. And yeah, I could just go on and on about how much difficulty, but how much fun and how much love there is surrounding this film from everybody involved.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm curious to dig in a little bit more on that, because I think that, you know, listeners at home, filmmakers themselves, we always love to hear about the struggle or the challenge or the under-discussed parts of filmmaking. You know, was there something in particular that you found, you know, have this not being your first rodeo, was a surprise challenge, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, just the fact that it wasn't my first rodeo and just how difficult it was to raise the money to make this film, to cast this film. Look, we always knew it was a small movie, and I wanted my next film to be a small film. I didn't want to have a big budget. I wanted the other thing that was imperative, unlike stand-up guys, which I really, you know, liked and had a good time. That wasn't my film. I was unable to choose my designer I wanted, my DP I wanted. I was a hired gun. And there was a guy above me, my producer, financier, who kind of really ran the show. And, you know, I got to do a bunch of things I wanted. I obviously got to cast and work with the great actors, but that was not my ultimate vision of that film, I would say. It was more his vision with me helping. So yeah, my requirement on this film was that I get to make it my film. If it fails, it's on me. It's not on anyone else. So yes, that's difficult. I knew I had going to have serious budget constraints. I still knew I needed to cast a leading man that people would want to see. And I knew I had to find the perfect kid, because without Palmer and Sam being amazing, this movie doesn't work. So there was all that. But it wasn't easy. I know a lot of people. I've been doing this a long time. I had a friend of mine who had recently sold his company that was very much kind of supportive of my career. And he had agreed to put up a certain amount of money for this movie that needed to be matched. And the original production company basically said they would, and they, you know, whatever happens, they couldn't find the money. It was a different actor. We hadn't even signed a deal. We were like talking to someone, but we were really full steam ahead at one point. And I remember I was just finishing up a documentary, I was in the middle of shooting a documentary, but I had always made an agreement that I would go on hold to make Palmer, but I got offered a really good acting role and I turned it down because I was in prep. And anyway, the bottom line is the whole thing went belly up and I was so depressed and so bummed out. And I didn't give up. I knew I had to make this film, and thank God it fell apart. Because it fell apart, I was making this documentary with Leonardo DiCaprio and his manager. I was so depressed. I said, could you read the script and help me cast this? I don't know who. I need help. I threw out some names, and his manager, a woman who works with him, Jennifer, knew a lot of actors. And she goes, Justin should play this part. And I was like, Justin? Justin Theroux? Justin Timberlake?
Justin Trudeau.
I'm like, oh my God, he's perfect. And I hadn't even thought of Justin Timberlake. And that was the transformative moment. Now, it wasn't like Justin read the script and said, yeah, let's shoot. No. Justin read the script, was very interested, happened to be just in the middle of a 16-month tour, world tour of his concert. So there was that. I knew I had to, you know, the guy wasn't even available for 8 months. But then that was good too, because it gave Justin and I time to know each other, because I didn't know this guy. And he had great notes. He had great insights, especially after talking to other actors. I was like, this guy gets it. He's from the South. He gets this guy. He's a new dad, you know, like me. We both had young sons. We understood Sam in so many ways. Anyway.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Yeah.
To ask about that? I think there's this idea, especially among new filmmakers, when you're trying to cast, you know, a star, that if you offer them a role that they've never played before, you know, like if, because right, Justin plays kind of a guy that's been, get out of prison, he got into fights, he's kind of like you said, like,
it's not, against type.
Not, right? Yeah, against type, against and type. Very yeah. different than like his Social Network character, for instance. Right.
Or Llewellyn Davis or Alpha Dog or anything else he's ever done. Yeah.
How much does that play into when you send him the script, and do you attach a letter? Do you set up a phone call? Like, how do you pitch him on the project beyond just sending him the script?
Well, everything is subjective. I had met Justin once before. I actually was trying to direct or film a concert of Otis Redding's 50th anniversary doing a concert at the Whiskey A Go Go. And I was trying to convince Justin to help me do a concert. That was years before. So I'd only met him once, and it was for something completely different. And because of my relationship with Leonardo's management company, you know, so they definitely knew me. I'd done two films with Leo at this point. So they put in a good word. So I had, you know, done a bunch of things. So that helped. So I did write a very long letter to Justin with the script. So I sent him the script, got him the letter. And yes, I guess it took him a couple of weeks, but he read it and he got back to me. And I could tell he was interested. And you're right. Part of the reason that I did think he was like, by the way, the money offer was basically non-existent. There was no money in this movie. But the upside is you get to play a great part, and you take ownership. You're my partner in this movie. You know, if it does well, we all do well. If it doesn't, we don't. But it's on us to make it as good as possible. And he gets that. He's done that many times. So, yeah. And I think what attracted him to this was that he hadn't played this type of role, that he knew this guy, Eddie Palmer. He's from the South. And it did take quite a bit of many meetings, many phone calls before he agreed. And then the last part of his agreement was, we can't start shooting till we have the kid. So, and I was like, absolutely, absolutely. And I had a kid that I loved when I was up and running before, when I thought I was. But by that point, that kid had grown too much. So we had to kind of restart.
That's the funniest thing about casting like young actors is it's like, oh, yeah, I have this amazing 7-year-old. By the time you get your movie off the ground, they're 12. Like,
nice to meet you like again, Mr. Stevens.
Yeah, yes, exactly. The voice changes. And yeah, the kid was taller than me. It's incredible. No.
So Ryder Allen is who you ended up casting. This was his first feature film, right?
Well, I think it was his first time speaking on film. I mean, he had a part in Law and Order playing one of the young Menendez brothers, no lines, and he did a commercial. That was it. But Ryder's sister had done a lot of commercials and was on a lot of sets, and Ryder kind of went with her to auditions, and he decided that he wanted to do this too, and that's how he got into it. And basically, Justin gave me 2 days to read with kids, with Sam's. And he said, like, a minimum 6 kids. I'll read with 30 if you have them, but I want at least 6. And I had 5 kids, and the writer was in my kind of maybe pile. And because he was 7, he was younger than the other kids. He wasn't exactly physically what I had expected. I had originally a different sort of physical vision of this child, but we just threw him in at the last minute.
And then at this point, all you've seen is tapes of them, right? Or have you actually met all
kids? No, I read Ryder by this point. But the finalists, I had been in a room with all of them.
Because with kids, you kind of need to see not just them on camera, but their relationship with their parents. Like how, like sometimes you have amazing kids that are amazing for like 5 minutes, and by minute 6, they are just bouncing off the walls, and it's hard to shoot with them because you have to take so many breaks, like refocusing them and things like that.
Well,
it's hard
like
to cast
you
them
said
off tape.
Too, I mean, people don't understand. You're not just casting the kids, you're casting their parents too, because their parents play a huge role in the entire relationship you have with the kid.
Yeah, it's so, a partnership yes. with them as well, right? Like if you
For
can get those parents
sure.
on your side, can you work with them? You know, is there, you're auditioning them in a sense as well.
It's like getting a techno crane without an operator.
Like, yes.
I kind of get this.
Yeah. But he had the coolest parents. At the time, I had just met his mother, but it was very clear. The mother had been used to this with her daughter and was incredible and incredibly supportive. Because it's tough material. I mean, it's really tough material. And Ryder just, I have to say, when I read, because I read with all the kids first. You know, I mean, I read with 100 kids. And when I read with Ryder, he was good, but there wasn't that kind of, I still didn't see it necessarily. But I saw enough in him that I thought, let's throw this guy in because he's 7. We'll have less time working on the set. I hope we don't cast him because he's too young. And as soon as Justin, I don't think Ryder knew who Justin was, Justin Timberlake. But as soon as they read together, it was like very clear that these two actors had incredible chemistry. And that was what was so interesting, was seeing Justin with these other kids. And it was just, wow, that was it. We knew. Justin was looking at me like, I'll remember the reading, and he's like the first scene, and we started, and then he just is looking at me like, you, like almost in shock at how good this kid was.
Well, let me ask you a kind of technical acting question. So over the course of the movie, Justin Timberlake starts very apprehensive. He's not interested in taking care of a kid. And, you know, by the end of the movie, their connection is quite strong. Do you feel like you need to shoot that type of relationship in order when you're in production in order to kind of track that, especially for a 7-year-old? Or is that not really something you're worrying about?
Well, if I had a big budget, I would definitely want to do that. There's no question. But there was no way we could do that. So what we did, and this is why having Justin and as a collaborating partner and writer is so good, is because they spend so much time with me rehearsing. We charted the entire film before we started shooting, really for that exact reason. I mean, Ryder really had to understand emotionally what was going on, because there were days where we would shoot one day, we'd have to go to 3 different days inside the script days, you know, 3 different scenes that took place different, just because of the nature of a 25-day shoot, having a boy 7 hours only or 6 hours to shoot. So we were just like run and gun. However, he was so prepared, and thank goodness he had an acting coach that was supposed to only come for the first week. And I convinced the producers to pay for her to stay the whole time. And she was so helpful and she was willing to do it. So she really helped me because I had so much going on with this movie that she helped me and Ryder understand, you know. But Ryder was super prepared. But that's a great question, because we needed him to know where he was at all times before and after each scene. That was another thing that was great about working with them. And one thing that I always have to do as an actor is know where I'm coming from and where I'm going in each scene and where it's coming out of. So we stress that quite a bit in shooting and in rehearsal.
Are there any other aspects of prep specifically with Ryder that was helpful in some way, you know, besides charting? You know, how do you prepare a 7-year-old who's never done a feature before?
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, but I just want, for our listeners and for Matt, you know, the people who have not seen the movie, I just want to stress that you mentioned this already, Fisher, but the role is challenging. I don't know how you describe the character, but he's a 7-year-old boy that seems, you know, to prefer wearing dresses and princess outfits. And he lives in the South in this very kind of like macho society. And he's bullied at school and his best friend is a girl. But even the adults are kind of, you know, laugh at him. And so for an adult, it's a difficult role. For a 7-year-old to even understand the nuance, part of me was wondering if the actor did understand the nuance or if it's better that he doesn't, because the character doesn't really seem to understand the nuance. Like, the character is not worried about that.
And you're forgetting he had to have a Southern accent.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I mean, and he had to wear crazy clothes.
Yeah. So Ryder is super intelligent. And I think he understood what was going on, certainly, the bullying and all that. There are two scenes in the movie two scenes where he had to break down. And then there's a third scene where he actually wasn't even needed to and wasn't scripted, but he started crying. I mean, it's one of the great moments in the movie too. This boy just, I was like, oh my, I lost it when he started crying. But anyway, so yeah, it's a hard thing. We're dealing with very difficult subject matter for a 7-year-old, for an 8-year-old, for anybody for that matter. And his parents were just super cool. I think his dad was a bit hesitant about him doing the role at the beginning. He said, just was worried, would Ryder A, be able to carry it, and B, like, it's a little too mature possibly for him.
Well, imagine you have kids now, right? Imagine saying like, oh, I'm going to have my kid be bullied on camera in these scenes for everyone to see. It's probably stressful. I have a daughter and.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You have to probably prepare yourself emotionally as a parent to, even though it's obviously all staged and it's not real, but it feels real, right? And that's what makes the movie good.
Yeah, it's a trip, man. I look at it as an actor. I had a lot of fun rehearsing with him, and you know, one of my joys of directing is that I can play the scenes with everyone in rehearsal. When, you know, if Justin is getting a costume fitting or doing it, whatever, I would always step in to just run it and run it and run it. We did a lot of working on these scenes, Ryder and I, with his coach. His mom was great. That's the thing. The parents have to kind of work the kids before work and make sure that they know what they're doing. And Amy
that they're
was
not
incredible.
Undoing your work. Do you know?
And
what I mean?
They're not undoing your work, which is what we started the conversation about, how important parents are.
And that the performance is still malleable, because a lot of times you'll see kids, they give a great first take and you try to change it, but they've rehearsed this way of doing it 1,000 times that they can't break out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I had one kid whose mother sat in the back and was kind of sort of directing him at the audition. And I knew that wasn't going to work. Anyway, yeah, we got really, this boy is special. And God, I really hope I can see him soon.
So I've worked with kids a little bit, but I saw this behind the scenes footage of Steven Spielberg working on E.T. and directing, you know, the kids in there. And it seemed like part of his method was really to like match the energy of the scene. And he seems like a kid when he's behind the camera. It's like, oh, that's, you know, that's so cool. Like, pick that up. Oh, it's scary. Oh, yeah. Okay, your character, you know, like, is that the energy matching? Is that, do you do that at all when you're working with kids? You know, it's less intellectual and more emotional.
You know, I never thought of that. But yeah, for sure I would do that. I wish I knew Steven Spielberg better, but I did. One of my inspirations for this film was Paper Moon, and I do know the director, Peter Bogdanovich, so I did call him to get advice about directing kids, because he, to me, one of the greatest kid performances, other than Spielberg being so successful, Peter Bogdanovich directing Tatum O'Neill in Paper Moon was a masterpiece, I thought, and I called him and asked him for his advice.
What did he say?
What he did with Tatum. He said that he, and I took his advice, but I also did what you said, just naturally. But he said that he would get down on her level always, only directed her at her level, eye level, and treat her like an adult and just treat her like another one of the actors and never let her get insecure, but at the same time, never baby her. Keep the confidence, but at the same time, make them understand that this is not, you know, they're as good as anyone else, and they're proper actors. Ryder was perfect for that, and he got that. But for sure, I would match the energy. I mean, there's moments I'm screaming like the scene, or I'm, you know, oh yeah, tons of that. I did exactly that. You can't help it with these kids. I mean, Spielberg did it, but I'm sure it's because he felt the energy of the scene. Is exactly right.
I kind of feel like as a director, it's your job, even if the crew, you know, the grips are all just like looking at their phones or everyone's like not that interested, it's your job to be like, this is the most important thing going on in your life right now. You know, what is behind that door? What is there? Like, I'm sure it's fun directing bullies too. Like, look at him.
That was tough. That boy, I cast the sweetest kid to be the bully, and that was tough. He had a lot of trouble getting there. And then he did, and he got it. He did a take that was so good, and he pushed Ryder, and then he felt so bad.
Sure, yeah.
He was 8 years old. You know, 8 year old, 8 years old.
Yeah,
amazing.
You know, at that age, also like the boundaries between make believe and real life are still flexible. They're still permeable. So it makes sense that you're getting these incredible performances, but that level of vulnerability, you know, it's hard for them to not take things personally. You know, did you ever find that like you were worried about crossing any sort of like emotional lines in terms of like how real things felt?
Yeah. With Ryder, I mean, there are moments where I got, he started getting emotional and he couldn't stop crying. It was a take where he couldn't stop crying, and which was just like, oh my God, this boy feels it so deeply. And I felt, oh my God, what have I done? But he's so mature that he got back. But there is a scene in the movie which is a, kind of the climactic scene where he couldn't stop crying. And what's so funny is when we shot the last day and we wrapped, it was such a powerful experience for him. He just started weeping of missing us and missing this experience.
I want to mention two things real quick for people that are listening. One is, I know we're talking a lot about crying and emotional stuff and bullying, but like the movie is actually quite bright and positive and fun and flows. And it's not like, if you're deciding what movie to watch, don't take us talking about all the crying as like that this is a downer. It's like a quite inspiring, like kind of uplifting movie. So I just want to put that out there to our listeners.
But you will cry.
You will. Yeah, it's moving for sure. But it's not like watching, like, it's not like, hey, let's put it on Schindler's List. You know, it's I enjoyed watching it, you know, like I wasn't just like bummed the whole time.
Good. No.
But I think the takeaway, especially for newer filmmakers, and I'm curious, actually, Matt, like your experience with this too, but I directed some things for Nickelodeon a few years ago, and they had acting coaches for the kids, and it was just like they're part of their standard thing. They're like, we always kind of have these acting coaches on set for the kids. And the kids were amazing. You know, those like all those Disney Nickelodeon kids, they're crazy. They're like robots. You like put 25 cents in and they knew the whole scene like incredibly well. But when I kind of was starting and like making YouTube videos and sketch videos and indie stuff, I never realized that that you could bring an acting coach. I thought it was like would make me a bad director if I have an acting coach on there. But I just want to say that just tell kind of some of the newer filmmakers that this is a role that does exist on set. And it, if you're nervous about directing kids, like there's no harm in bringing someone else to help you, especially with that part. So, you know, Matt's.
Yeah. You just have to draw boundaries. Right. And also, you know, I would have preferred obviously to have had more time with Ryder, but when you're doing a film in 25 days and you only have 6 hours a day, she is amazing. Lori Lively is her name, acting coach for kids. She's incredible. Oh my God. So we, you know, and I would meet with her and discuss with her what I needed, you know, and I would rehearse with Ryder and she would watch and I would say, Lori, can you keep working in this direction? And, you know, she was amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's like any other part of filmmaking, right? You set up kind of the direction you want it to go, but then you can multitask while someone else is helping you.
Right. And she was from the South, which was great. So we could always work on Ryder's accent. And Justin helped him with the accent because Justin's from the South. So
yeah, I think it's interesting. I think kind of to the point we were making before about just making sure that you have the same methodology, right? And it sounds like, Fisher, that's exactly right for you, but that you speak the same language, so to speak, you know?
I'm curious. You've worked with, like, obviously a zillion great directors. How do you, as an actor, do you pay attention on set to, like, where the lights are, what the schedule, like, how much are you pulling as an actor to bring into your directing, especially your scripted stuff?
It depends. You know, sometimes I'm just so relieved that I don't have to deal with anything but my lines. It's like, oh, thank God. I don't have to worry about making the day or where the lights go. I don't have to talk to the producers about budget. Oh, it's so wonderful. But I have to say, being on Succession was a different situation because I was so enamored with the way it was being shot and the actors. That inspired me for Palmer because I went right from working on that to going into the actual production. So watching the way, there's a director that I'm absolutely like think is brilliant on Succession, who's the main, I guess, the main director named Mark Mylod. And I just loved, he's British, but he's done a lot of TV and a few movies, but I just love watching him work. And I love the way he communicates with the actors and I love the way he communicates with the camera people. And I really noticed that while I was on the show. I'd say I took a lot from that. And that show shoots with film and always with two cameras, sometimes
both
three cameras.
And eyebrows just bounced when you said
on
film,
because it's like wild. Such a, yeah, especially the pilot was kind of like zoomy. There's a little kind of docu feel to it, which I guess I associate with video, but I don't know why I would.
Yeah, no, that's shot with film.
Can you tell us some of the specifics of like the takeaways of like what you took away about communicating with actors and communicating with your camera crew that you picked up on Succession?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, I hired like an amazing DP, Tobias Schleisler, who I had shot for me on And We Go Green, one of my documentaries about electric car racing. And I could tell this guy who's done like, you know, $100 million movies was really into getting the camera back on his shoulder. And he happened to had a movie fall apart right before I was starting the film. And I begged him to do this for, you know, and he's told me he's had lighting budgets bigger than our whole budget.
Don't you love it when somebody says that to you?
Well, he didn't say it to me, by the way. I overheard him yelling at the producer, you know, talking to the producer because he was trying to get a light. But anyway, it wasn't like he said to me. But still, like my experience with two cameras is very, I have a lot of experience doing documentary work, but Succession is all about basically you stage the scene, you shoot the whole scene with one lighting setup, and then you go around and you change the light a little bit, but you basically keep doing the scene over and over as a full scene, which is so fun for the actors and so refreshing. And you don't do that on TV often, you know, it's pick it up from here, pick it up. So I brought that into Palmer for sure, where with Tobias and, you know, we couldn't afford film, but we found these K35 lenses, these old 70s lenses that looked beautiful that Ridley Scott had actually used for Blade Runner. And we had this great kind of flow going and kind of this outline of how we were going to work. And I think Succession, you know, it does the same thing, which is great, which is why it's like you feel like you're in a theater company because you're just doing it over and over and over again. And it's so it's wonderful as the actor because you get many shots at it. And I tried to do that on a lower budget scale with Justin and Sam and Ryder. And I think we all felt like I think it was a really good experience for the actors as well.
Can I ask a technical question about that? Because you mentioned that your DP, you know, he was operating, it sounds like.
Well, no, he wasn't fully operating because he wasn't. Yeah, whatever. But he did something.
He was getting his hands dirty in a different way than he used to.
For sure. Gotcha. For sure.
But so he could keep an eye on both cameras at the same time. Like you. Yeah.
That's why he couldn't operate fully. And again, the beauty of Palmer making this film, unlike my other film that I directed, was like it was me and Tobias by the monitor. That was it. You know, these producers were wonderful. They were maybe at another monitor and they were wonderful. They were. But basically, it was me and Tobias. And you know, it was a very much a small footprint. We wanted to keep a small footprint. So, often Tobias, you know, would grab the camera and have to jump in.
Yeah. My dream is always to like do those, like, you know, let's just run the whole scene. Let's run the whole scene. And then the low budgets that I work in, like, you know, the blocking starts becoming really, you want people to move around and do things, but well, they can't walk here because, you know, we're not lit for that. And we're not lit for this. But yeah, I guess on a show like Succession, you kind of light these giant spaces and you get to do that.
Well, we try to do that with Tobias, and the beauty of the K35 lenses in the Sony Venice camera is you can shoot with less light, you know, although he's still brilliant, had to light, but you know, it's amazing what you can do when you have to.
And how do you guys plan the movie? Are you like a shot lister, storyboard, or do you need to see locations first and act things out?
Oh yeah. Locations are crucial. I look at locations as characters always. Like a big part of this movie, and hopefully you don't even notice it, but the locations are a huge part of this movie because we wanted it to be authentic. And, you know, you just wanted everything to blend in so that you're just like real life watching real life. So color palette was huge. Locations were huge. I would shot list every day, but I would only storyboard the fight scene and the big ending. I only storyboarded those. Essential to storyboard fight scenes, I think, and essential that the big ending kind of scene. I had one night to shoot like a huge. I mean, it was impossible. I don't know how we did it, but it worked out. But I storyboarded every frame of that, and then let it go, and then shot it like a doc. But I knew I had the script, and then I could throw it away. I got the script, but then it gave me room to get even better, to do more.
Yeah. Well, and when you're running full scenes like that, you can become a little opportunistic, right? Like you've got your shot list, but one of your cameras maybe already is covered, you know, is covering a piece already. So like your operator gets to maybe like riff a little bit, which is always.
It's important.
Yeah. Yeah.
I still. I'm not going to say where, but there's this one moment I still didn't feel like covered correctly. It was a cutaway in a big scene. But anyway, I always look at that. We eked it out in the edit, but it was something where I just kind of dropped and we ran out of time.
Did you guys do any pickups for the movie?
No.
Oh, that's brutal. When you're like, ah, oh, we needed that one piece, it makes this whole scene work so much better.
Oh, it was incredible, man. It was, oh, well, wait, you mean pick, we did do two pickups inside of our shooting day, you know, like after.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
but yeah. Like, it wasn't like we went back to the location after we finished shooting. And one of those pickups we never used, I don't think we used either one, to tell you the truth. But no, I mean, gosh, that's the other thing. Like we finished shooting and that was the movie. You know, nowadays, most people do pick up, but we didn't.
Well, let me ask, because it sounds like, you know, you've had such a breadth of different experiences, right? Like you can do big movies, you can do small movies, you can act and hit TV shows, all of that stuff. And now with Palmer under your belt, what size project do you want to do next? What's the sweet spot? Have you found your favorite sort of level? Like, do you miss the creature comforts, or is it worth it for the creative freedom?
Well, you know, you can talk to Tobias, who does $100 million movies and he'll say, oh, we always have this similar, we always have problems. We never have enough time to shoot. We always, you know, the big difference is you stay in a nicer hotel, you drink more expensive bottles of wine after work, and you have 1,000 extras. Otherwise, no, I would like to have more than 25 days to shoot my next movie, unless it's like in one room. I'd say the biggest challenge for this was the days, especially since Sam could only work 6 hours a day. So that was, I definitely don't want to do that again. That was probably the most difficult. And you know, there were a couple of, everybody was great, but it would have been nice to been able to have flown in a few more people that I've worked with to be in key positions, but we couldn't, you know. And by the way, people were amazing in Louisiana. There were great people there, but you know, there's a couple like people I always work with that I would have felt comfortable with.
You have a history with people, right? Yeah,
exactly. So it would be nice. I did get to hire, you know, my designers, which was amazing, and they were amazing. So, but I'd like to do something maybe with a little more bulk in terms of budget, but maybe I would love to do a period piece as a director. I'm not talking about Elizabethan or Victorian. I'm talking about maybe even 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s.
Yeah. 80s. I mean, I think Palmer has kind of a little bit of that timeless quality too. And maybe it's because you're shooting in the South. Maybe, you know, there's that,
well,
that texture,
it was also,
of wood and nature and stuff.
Yeah. Small exactly. Town. I mean, that was very deliberate. That was very, like, all of my influences for Palmer were older films, you know, all the films that I watched were, and also, those are the films I love, you know, and Justin and I, we watched, you know, we got really deep into Paul Newman in his 20s, 30s and 40s and Steve McQueen and, you know, those kind of films, Fat City, Stacy Keach. I mean, we went, you know, that was one of my favorite inspirations for this movie, and documentaries, but old documentaries.
I do wonder though, just in the production of the film, how a film about, with the themes of unity, right? You know, the idea of unity is something that everyone can get behind, right? Once you kind of go a layer or two deeper, do you find that in talking about the film and kind of introducing yourself to that world, that was a part of the conversation, or was it a little more, you know, business?
You mean, was that part of the conversation when I needed a church as a location?
Yeah, yeah.
Some of the,
yeah,
it's
a great, for instance.
Oh, for
yeah.
Sure. Oh, no, no. For sure. Part of, I mean, there were, to be honest, there was a couple of locations that we wanted to use, one in particular where they asked to read the script and we gave them the script and they said, no, I don't want you shooting here. But then there were a lot of the others, like the church read the script and they were like, all for it, you know? It's a beautiful story.
That's what I really loved about the movie. Obviously, great performances, but I did like how underplayed that was and how the people didn't seem like, here's a Southerner that thinks one way and here's a, you know, person, here's a bad guy and here's a good guy. Like, even the bad guys kind of felt bad for doing bad things and the good guys felt bad for doing good things. You know, that there's a lot of that gray area of, like, it's not just like us versus them. And, you know, Justin's whole character is like, you know, he's like a kind of roughneck Southerner that's just got out of prison, and he can sympathize with a kid that, you know, maybe a lot of people would not accept.
Exactly. I like that about the script. And even Ryder's, Sam's mother, you know, she's a disaster, crystal meth addict, and leaves the boy for weeks at a time. But at the same time, she always supported who he was. She allowed him to be who he was. She gave him confidence. She gave him self-esteem to let him be who he was. So there's a lot of that, I think, in the story, hopefully.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much. If people want to find out more about Palmer, I think it comes out January 29th, right? On Apple?
Yeah, January 29th on Apple Plus, and playing about 25 to 30 movie theaters, socially distanced. Yeah.
Are you cool with hanging out with us just for a couple more minutes for our unpaid endorsement segment?
Oh, sure.
Unpaid endorsements.
So my unpaid endorsement is the film Sound of Metal, The Sound of Metal. I caught it just recently. I really loved it. It's a little unassuming at first. Like, I think I love a film that kind of goes through three very clearly different phases. You know, like, you start in one world and by the end of the film, you had no idea where you were headed, you know. But I think it's a really incredibly acted. I mean, everyone's talking about Riz Ahmed as, like, you know, Oscar-worthy sort of performance. But I guess I just hadn't it wasn't really on my radar, and I wasn't totally sure that it would be my thing, and I just was surprised by how much I loved it, basically. And I think that's...
I mean, you are a metalhead.
Yeah, you know, you well, love it's so funny. I don't mind metal, but my sister-in-law didn't want to watch it because she thought it was about, like, heavy metal, and like... You know, immediately it's about an experience, basically. You know, you spend like maybe 10, 15 minutes in the metal scene and then you are in a different planet in a way that's really great.
And he's losing his hearing, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And he's a drummer.
Yeah. Yeah. It's and also what they do with sound and how they the sound design and the subjective camera makes you really get inside the head of the character and kind of watch his transformation and feel as though you're a part of that journey in a way that's really incredible. And I think, you know, maybe is a kind of an interesting doubleheader with Palmer, actually. I think there's probably some similarities there.
Or a triple header.
I want to see it. What's a triple header?
This is definitely a shameless plug, but there have been a few lists where people have said, if you liked Sound of Metal, you might like these other movies. And one of them happens to be a movie I directed called The Hammer, which is about a deaf UFC fighter named Matt Hamill. It's a true story. But we also play a lot with sound and sign language and trying to visualize and find the soundscape of, you know, the senses of what it is to be deaf or hard of hearing. So, well, Fisher, what do you got?
So I was just thinking that I think the world would be a better place if everybody had a green juice every morning.
Do you juice yourself?
Well, here's the problem, man. They're expensive. I got a juicer and I went, you know, you get it's incredible how many vegetables it takes to get a glass of juice. It's kind of a bummer, but it's amazing how good you feel after you drink it.
Yeah, 100%. What's your...
I don't know. That sounds so like white privilege.
No, I love it though. I love it. I think your point is you are like blown away by how much like, you're like, oh, I put like a whole bushel of
kale. I just can't believe how...
Kale, yeah.
But also how good I feel after I have one. Like that's what I'm...
I want to know the mix.
People have been telling me for years.
What's your cocktail?
It's kale, spinach, a little celery, cucumber, apple, blueberry and kiwi is
Ooh,
my
blueberry
ideal.
Interesting move.
Yeah, I put blueberry in. I don't know. I was just trying to get away from movies because I've been talking movies since
yeah no
10
that's
this
great
morning.
Do you guys drink like a lot of water first thing when you wake up?
I drink every morning. I drink a 16 ounce glass of water and I put either half or a full lemon in it every
I've heard
morning.
Successful people like drink a lot of water in the morning, and I've had this like kind of revelation recently. Mike Birbiglia tweeted just asking people how many cups of coffee they drink a day, and there was just, you know, 10,000 people responded, and I drink 2 cups a day, and a lot of people were mentioning that for every cup of coffee you drink, you need to drink a cup of water just to offset that cup of coffee because of how much it dehydrates
Shit.
You. And I'm like, maybe
oh
that's why
God.
I'm getting migraines.
I'm in trouble.
Because I drink a little bit of water, yeah. Then I drink 2 coffees with barely any water, and then I get a crazy headache. And it's because I think it's because I'm dehydrated. So I think the green juice might offset that too. My endorsement is this YouTube channel, which is actually, it's called Wandering DP. So he has a podcast. I'd heard of it. A lot of people talk about it. But his YouTube channel, he's a cinematographer. He does mostly commercials. Just super great speaker, and he's pretty funny too. He kind of like reminds me of Andrew Kramer, for those of you that don't know, is like the VFX master that taught a whole generation of kids how to do visual effects. But Wandering DP, I think his name is Patrick O'Sullivan. He never mentions his name. He never plugs himself for work, but he takes beautifully shot commercials, like multi-million dollar commercials from all over the world. He brings them into DaVinci Resolve, and he just plays them. He looks at the levels, the light levels, and he just talks about how every shot was lit. He says, look at here. You know, we have the sun coming in from here. Look, this is beautiful. And we cut to the reverse. And why are we doing the reverse from here? Because we know that the light is sitting right here. And why are we doing this? And he's talking about lighting, but he's also in the process talking about directing, talking about blocking, talking about where an actor's eyeline should be. He talks about production design. It's like wallpaper. Maybe we can shoot in Eastern Europe. Maybe we'll get some wallpaper here. We don't have wallpaper, so we're going to make this white wall look darker. We're going to put this square on there. We're going to do the Rembrandt. Look at that. I could just watch him all day, and he literally, even though I'm a pretty technical person, I like cameras, and I feel like I understand things, he makes me ask my DP more questions. Like, well, what if we just did like a 12 by bounce here? What if the sun was just over here? And what if we change this angle? And it's just like I've just fallen in love with just watching him watch commercials and talk about how they were shot. Wandering DP, he's on YouTube, and I even bought, even though I'm, you know, just have like I don't have a ton of room, but I bought like an 8x frame and some grid and some muslin and some silks and a 6x frame because I literally just want to try out what the lighting, because, you know, he'll show Cindy Crawford from a Pepsi commercial. He's like, look, this is how they do it. Sun here, bounce above, diffusion here. And I'm like, oh, I can buy it. Like, you know, I can set that up and I'll take my wife out there and let's see if we can get the same look. I've had a real DIY type of year, Fisher, where I bought a camera and I bought some other gear because I want to go back to just making things on my own without having to have a crew. And so part of my evolution.
It's your time to do it, man. Time to do it. Isolation, quarantine.
Awesome. Fisher, thank you so much.
Thanks, Fisher Stevens, for joining us. It was great chatting with you. You heard, if you want to check out Palmer, it's on Apple Plus, January 29th. If you want to find out more about anything we talked about, please email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com. You can check out what we talked about, all the notes, all the endorsements, everything at justshootitpod.com, our website. You can find us on all social media at Just Shoot It Pod. I'm on Instagram at @okaplan and on Twitter at @smightypyleg.
And I'm at Mr. Matt Enlow across all social media, including Letterboxd. I've seen some people following me.
Ooh, lucky. By the way, yeah, I'm on TikTok too, if you at @smightypyleg.
Oh, look out.
Because at @okaplan was taken. What's going on?
We're social butterflies. This episode was edited by Sarah Weirda, and our social media manager is Derek Aiello. You're listening to music provided by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
This is the summer to expand your horizons. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate travel shoes from Allbirds. Like the breathable, silky smooth tree dasher, the responsive foam and extra grip of the tree runner, or the classic low-top look of the tree piper. Allbirds has a lightweight, ultra-packable shoe ready for whatever adventures you have planned. Boarding pass? Check. Passport? Check. The perfect travel shoe? Check. Find your perfect pair at Allbirds.com. That's ALLBIRDS.com.